So that's healthy inflation, but the inflation we had in the U.S. was 9%, so pretty close to hyperinflation territories. And the central banks around the world, particularly the Fed in the U.S., has really one lever to battle inflation, and that's by increasing rates, increasing the Fed's funds rate.
What is your opinion of where are we right now in the cycle of things?
Where we are at today, I mean, this new environment we are is very interesting because as far as the real estate cycle goes, I would say we're probably either in... Yeah, I'll give you a legal type of answer back. A lot of lawyers like to say it depends. So it really depends. Real estate is localized. So it depends what is the asset class you're focused on. What is the business model you're looking to execute? I invested in a development project here in Southwest Florida, and it was a great deal. We made great profits on that. I've invested in the debt instrument. I love to diversify, particularly in other asset classes. Like, I believe in industrial. Industrial is a great asset class under the commercial real estate umbrella. We also started our other vertical, which is built to rent.
What advice can you give to a beginner? Where do they start?
Hopefully it's a beginner in raising capital and not beginner in development, because development is very sophisticated. Development is a lot of moving parts in developing deals, and development is probably the fastest way to go bankrupt in real estate because you're building something from nothing, and a lot of things could go wrong within that journey of times.
Welcome to Real Estate Development Land to Legacy. Augustinas, welcome to the show. Excited to have you. We will talk about real estate investments, syndications, how to raise capital, what it takes to develop and to finance and to acquire or rehab deals. We might touch about cross-border trading and investments going back and forth to our neighbors to the north and the other way around. August, welcome. Tell us why you are the best guest on the show to talk about all these subjects.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Eugene, thanks for having me. As far as being the best guest, I'll try my best, but I would say launching a company right before COVID hit in early 2020s, late 2019, and having survived what has gone on in the real estate market might be able to give me that feather in the cap to say that I'm worthy to be on some of your top guests. But yeah, it has been a interesting ride and somewhat of a storm in that time period. Obviously, soon after we launched CPI Capital, there was a worldwide pandemic, which resulted in, not only distress in the real estate space, but in people, being worried about survival, right? And a lot of governments had to make sure people could still survive. So they started, sending payments and paychecks to people's bank accounts, hoping that they would stay at home and not go out because they didn't know what the extent of this thing was. And obviously, there's a lot of conspiracies there, but I'm not going to get into that. So that resulted in people having a lot of time on their hand and a lot of money in their bank account. And it's resulted in some exuberance and people spending. And what happens when people spend a lot of money? It results in suppliers and people who are selling product to increase prices, and people keep buying. And that resulted in something called inflation. And inflation is not a good thing. I mean, healthy inflation is a good thing. Inflation being at 2.5% is healthy. Why is it healthy? Why is inflation, any inflation healthy? Is because it's healthy. It results, stops people from hoarding money. It's, makes people go out there and spend money, because if they don't spend money, price of goods and services will increase, so they don't have to put money in their mattresses. It also stimulates people borrowing money from the bank. They know if they borrow $1 million from the bank today, because of inflation, they have to pay the bank less money in the future. So the money they have to repay is worth less. So that's healthy inflation, but the inflation we had in the U.S. was 9%, so it's pretty close to hyperinflation territories. And the central banks around the world, particularly the Fed in the U.S., has really one lever to battle inflation, and that's by increasing rates, increasing the Fed's funds rate. So that's what they did. But before doing that, because of what was happening with the economy, global economy, the Fed actually reduced their rates to zero to 0.25, resulted in a lot of money coming into real estate and money being invested in real estate. But they had to fight inflation. So what they did is they increased rates, and which went from zero to 500 basis points to 5% to 5.25%, which has resulted in some distress in the real estate space. But I'm sure we're going to get into that. I'll stop there for now.
No, that's excellent. I mean, you're talking about all the things that I'm super passionate excited about. I call myself an armchair economist. I did get a bachelor's degree in economics 25 years ago. So I still know like the basic two facts, but I love discussing economy and what's happening in the economy and talking about forecasts. Having said that, what is your opinion of where are we right now in the cycle of things?
Yeah, no. That's a great question and an important question. Where we are at today, I mean, this new environment we are is very interesting because as far as the real estate cycle goes, I would say we're probably either in recession or near recession phase of the cycle. As I'm sure you're aware, real estate goes through this continuous cycles, right? That's what it's called, a real estate cycle, because it's real estate is never up and down. It goes through these continuous cycles. So it goes recession, recovery, expansion, and hypersupply. And currently, I would say we're either in recession or near recession. And why is that? Because, you know, you're seeing some distress in the real estate market. You're seeing corrections in prices. You're seeing interest rates still being somewhat high. Relatively speaking, obviously, the Fed dropped the rates today by 25 basis points. It's the second time they've dropped rates. So that is an indication that the economy might not be doing very well. We also have a somewhat new administration in the office in the U.S. presidential administration. So historically, Donald Trump has been a real estate guy. He served another term as a president. But in this term, some of the policies that he is employing are somewhat inflationary and somewhat not very friendly to real estate. For example, when you talk about the tariffs. So, you know, when you talk about tariffs, putting tariffs, for example, on Canada for lumber and other material, that has an effect on construction prices. So if the construction prices are affected, it increases the cost of construction and makes less supply coming onto market. You also have concerns with immigration and ICE agents going and arresting a lot of illegals and what have you. But believe it or not, a lot of people in the construction industry in the southern states are actually illegals in some cases. So the concerns there could result in increased prices in labor. And that hasn't been the case on a project that we were working on in San Antonio, luckily. But some of those policies are inflationary that Trump is utilizing. So interesting times. But you can also see recently gold prices broke an all-time high in history. So anytime you see that, you know that's flight to safety. Like capital is going there, as because it's worried about what's happening macroeconomically. But could possibly be a good thing for commercial real estate because we know that if the Fed keeps reducing rates, that's going to result possibly in price of debt being cheaper for commercial real estate. So a lot of those deals that were not penciling might start penciling out. But I would look at it if real estate was a clock and 12 o'clock is top of the market and 6 o'clock is the bottom of the market, what time is it today? It's not advised not to time the market. It's important in real estate. You don't want to time the market because you might miss. But it's important to have a basic understanding of at least whereabouts are we. And I would say we're definitely much closer to 6 o'clock than 12 o'clock. So are we before it's 6 o'clock? Are we right after 6 o'clock? Where are we at today? Very near 6 o'clock, I would say. And where we got over the last 5 years has been a roller coaster of events that resulted in where we are. But even today, I mean, geopolitically, there's wars happening around the world. The Russia-Ukraine conflict is still ongoing. There is a pause in the Middle East conflict. I would call it a pause, even though they call it a ceasefire, because right after the ceasefire, the Israelis, sending some more bombs and missiles. So, and the same thing from the other side, the Palestinians did some attacks or what have you. So that's a pause on the conflict there that's ongoing. So interesting times in real estate, but there's always opportunities and happy to discuss those as well.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, let's get into it. So is now a good time to buy? Or would you say it's still best to wait? And if you are buying, then what are you buying?
Yeah, I'll give you a legal type of answer back. A lot of lawyers like to say it depends. So it really depends. Real estate is localized. So it depends what is the asset class you're focused on. What is the business model you're looking to execute? And particularly in our space, multifamily value add, where we go in and buy somewhat older apartment communities, do some level of renovation, interior, upgrade a tenant profile, make the property manage the property more efficiently, bring in a better property manager or manage it internally ourselves. There's always efficiencies that can go in there. So that's our business model. Now, in that model, debt is such an important component of deals making sense. Why? Why is debt so important? Because the cost of capital is the highest cost associated with buying a deal like a multifamily deal. So if the cost of capital is high, relatively speaking, especially if the cost of capital was very low just a few years ago, a lot of current owners are looking at their properties and like, hey, my property was valued 30, 40% more than what it is today, or maybe not 30, but 20 to 30, 40% less than what it was valued just a couple of years ago. I'd rather just wait and sell this as long as they can wait, as long as they have a decent loan on their property and they can wait. They're like, I might as well just wait because I don't want to take that type of a loss, that type of a haircut. I'll just wait. So there isn't a lot of deals coming into market, and deals that are coming in, they're just not trading. So there is a bid-ask spread that exists between what buyers are willing to pay and what the sellers are willing to part ways with their properties. And when it comes to an investment firm like us, when you talk about a bid-ask spread or why deals don't pencil out, let me define that a bit more. Because as an investment firm, we are equity. The money needed for our deal comes from the bank. Majority comes from the bank or financial institutions that lend money to us. But the remainder of it, the down payment as per se, comes from investors. The equity comms from the our investors, LP investors, limited partners who put up their money and they partner with us in a partnership to buy these properties. Those investors want to get a certain type of yield and returns on their money that they put in. If you want to invest in something that's an alternative, a real estate syndication, a real estate fund managed by a boutique firm, you want to get at least 15 to 20% average annualized return as an investor. So if that's the yield and return our investors are asking for, when we look at a deal, that's the type of return that we have to get to our investors at least. So let's say 20% average annualized return over a five-year period. So if an investor puts in $100,000, we're trying to double that investor's capital over the 5 years period. That means we're trying to double the equity that we put into a deal over a five-year period. But is that possible? Can we achieve that if we do this? Now, we have to get paid as well. So we charge a set of fees and we try to get a portion of the upside, that back in profits. We want to make sure our investors get 20% average annualized returns net of any promote or carried interest that we charge. So we need to earn a living as well. So when we factor all of those numbers into our underwriting, into our analysis, and compare it to what the price that the seller wants to sell it at, the numbers don't make sense. That's what it means when deals, that's what I'm saying, when somebody says the deals don't make sense, that's what they're really meaning to explain. So is it a good time? I would say in certain markets, it's a great time to buy. In other markets, it depends. We are hyper-focused on Tampa in Florida, and we're hyper-focused on San Antonio in Texas. So those markets are similar, but they're also vastly different. For example, in Tampa, the current average occupancy is sitting somewhere between low 90s to 95%. That's what the average market occupancy is in Tampa. And when we look at the rent-to-value ratios, we're trying to achieve approximately a 1% rule. What that means is if you buy an apartment community, we want to see what is our average per-door purchase price. What is the average price per door that we purchase this property at? So let's say we purchase the property at $150,000 on an average per-door basis. And we want to make sure our rents are our average in-place monthly rents per unit are 1% of a per unit price that we're purchasing the property. So if we're buying the property at $150,000 a door, we want our average monthly rent to be at $1,500 a door. And we're achieving that in Tampa, something around that, maybe a little less, but definitely not more. We're achieving that approximately. In San Antonio is vastly different because the market occupancy is sitting somewhere between 85 to 90%. So is a bit less than it is in Tampa. So the rent to value ratios are actually higher than what they are in Tampa. So if we're buying a property at, let's say, $100,000 per door average price, the in-place rents, monthly interest place rents are around $1,200 a door. So they're higher than what they are in Tampa. So we have to account for, we can't just say, hey, our vacancy is going to be standard 5% vacancy that we underwrite deals. We got to say, no, our vacancy is going to be at 15%. And so on. So, being in two different markets, it allows us to get a better feel for what's happening across the U.S. and trying to make deals pencil out in both of these markets.
Excellent. That's a very interesting insight and how you calculate that ratio of return revenue rent per door in relation to the cost of the unit. Some of the similar underwriting could be done when developing new construction. How do you account for future capital appreciation? Obviously, nobody has a crystal ball. We all, at least you and me and a few other folks that I frequently talk to, believe that we are near the bottom of the market, which means we are looking at the next cycle of upside coming up in the next several years. How do you forecast that growth? And, you know, do you still use the fixed ratio for rent increases and your expense increases, or do you factor in some sort of a capital appreciation, or is it the cap rate? What is the formula that you use?
No, absolutely. Great question. So to answer that question, we got to take a step back and look at what are ways to increase value on a property, right? So one way that property increases in value is organic growth. You have that either in a development deal, or if you're buying a single family or multifamily or built to rent, all asset classes under commercial real estate umbrella or residential, there is organic natural market appreciation that takes place. A good stat to keep in mind is from 1948 till 2009, single family homes in the U.S. increase in value every single year in that time period. So there's natural market appreciation. You ensure of that when you invest in markets that are have a potential for growth. So markets that have job growth, population growth, income growth, they're markets that people want to move into. They're not a boom and bust market like a Las Vegas type of market. So a slow and steady type of market. So markets that have done tremendously well over the last 10 or 15 years are Phoenix and Dallas. Those have been a really boom markets, but they do also have issues when it comes to hypersupply. So one aspect to look at is this market I'm investing in going to have that natural growth that markets have? And how we account for that is in our analysis, we put in natural rent growth. Now, why did we add natural rent growth, organic rent growth, rather than asset appreciation, is because in commercial real estate, in multifamily, properties are not assessed by comparable approach. They're rather assessed by the income approach. So you have to look at the property as income. You have to guesstimate what is your income growth going to be? What is your organic income going to be, rather than what is the organic asset value? We factor the organic asset appreciation by factoring in our increasing NOI, increasing in income through increasing in rent. So we put in a 3% organic rent growth per year on a property we're purchasing over a five-year period. So that takes care of the organic growth. Now, in some markets like San Antonio, where there is a concern about oversupply currently, and there is some distress in the market, we completely eliminate the first year 3% rent growth. We put that at zero. And then year two, we put it at 1.5%. And then we move it up to maybe 2.5% and we keep it there. So we're trying to be conservative there and try to be realistic rather than conservative. It's just the way you have to be. Then on other component where appreciation is created is through forced appreciation. So for example, when you talk about development, you're taking a piece of land, you are entitling it, you're building something on it, and you're selling it. You created value through that entitlement process and through the construction and development process. So in renovation, same thing. You're buying something, you're renovating it, and you're creating value. In multifamily value add, the concept is the same thing. You're buying a property, you are going in there doing renovations, capital expenditure as it's called in multifamily, and you're increasing the value as a result of being able to getting higher yield on renovated units than your unrenovated units. You're creating value, you're force appreciating. You are, updating, you're bettering the tenant profile. If there are tenants that have been delinquent or they're causing some issues in the apartment community, you go ahead and get rid of those tenants, bring in a better tenant profile. If the property management is not pulling their weight, you bring in on a better property management. If the marketing is not good, you go in there and do better marketing, get better Google reviews, getting more driven traffic to the properties. It's just like buying a business. Buying a multifamily apartment community is buying like buying a business. You go in there and you force appreciate it. So you do it through buying right, so you get the good and decent market appreciation, organic market appreciation, and then you also force appreciating the property through the different steps in your business plan constitutes.
Makes sense. Yeah, of course, I'm in the market of ultimate force appreciation by building a new building on a raw piece of land. So there we have it. So the 2.5-3% escalator that we put in a pro forma for rent growth, that's always been my benchmark for many years that I've been building models. I recently debated whether that's still accurate. Obviously, we had a long period of super low inflation for many years, and then all of a sudden it spiked up, as you mentioned, to 9%. What is your forecast going forward? Do you still keep it at 3% when you build new models, or are you changing it? And then secondary question to that is, what do you do with your expenses? Because obviously expenses grow with our inflation just the same way. And sometimes it's, or most of the time, it's fairly imbalanced. Back in the day, I remember we used to grow revenue by 3% linearly for like 10 years, and then we'd grow our expenses by 2%. And of course, you look at the model 10 years down the road, you've got this huge value created. Whether it's realistic or not, you know, there were some examples that it worked, some examples that it didn't. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, to answer your latter question, when it comes to expense, you do the same thing. You do a staggered increase in expenses over time. So that's how you ensure that your expenses are accounted for as inflation comes into place, or as increased prices in material and labor come into play. So you have to account for that. As far as the 3% when it comes to market, it really depends on the market. And it depends on your current footprint and exposure in that market. So we have a deal in Tampa, in Florida, so we know what's happening. So we underwrote to 3% rent growth. Our current organic rent growth is at 4.5%. The property is not in the A neighborhood, A-class neighborhood, is probably maybe a C-plus B neighborhood, but this is achieving 4.5% organic rent growth. So we understand, and we keep close contact with brokers in the market and so on. So we have ongoing monthly calls with our top brokers in the market to see what they're seeing and what's happening. So we got a good sense of what's happening in the market. So when we are going in an underwriting, if the market is showing a 4% rent growth, we still keep it conservative at that 3%. But in a market like San Antonio, when there is hyper supply and there is a large amount of vacancy in the market and you're seeing distress, Blackstone brought a deal to us, a broker brought the deal, but it's a Blackstone deal, is a two-deal portfolio. Blackstone had the debt note on these deals and they foreclosed on their property. Now, the asking price that they just brought this deal to, these two deals to us, is less than the note that they're holding on the property. So they're getting a haircut there. We underwrote the deal and we can only go up to 80% of the asking price. So they're getting a huge loss there. Now, another group might come and be able to pay more, but their asking price alone is less than their note. So it really depends. Your underwriting and analysis really depends on the market. Another issue with San Antonio is inverted rent roll. It's a concept that I wasn't familiar with until recently. You know, but what's happening in some of these properties in San Antonio, and I don't want to talk negatively. I'm very bullish about San Antonio. I think long-term it will do really well. Right now it's going through its bust cycle and markets do that. So I think as time goes on, San Antonio will do tremendously well because there's so many public-private infrastructure going in. As you drive through San Antonio, you can see bridges being built, raised highways, but it's a great time to enter that market. So it's really market-dependent on where things are. But I was talking about inverted rent roll. An inverted rent roll concept is where your in-place rents are more than your current advertised rents to bring in tenants. Now, that sounds absolutely insane, right? You have tenants living in your property. They're paying, let's say, $1,200 in rent, and they go online or they hear from a neighbor or a friend that your advertised rents are $1,000. So what do some of these tenants do? They literally move out and they come back into the property at a lower basis. So that's what's happening. And that's something you really don't want to see, right? But if you do see it, and it's a market that has good fundamentals, that's a market you want to enter and you want to go into. So yeah, to answer a long-winded answer to your question, when it comes to how do you underwrite, it depends on the market, depends on the asset class, depends on the property itself, and depends on your business plan as well.
Oh, that's amazing. Let's shift gears a little bit. We dangled that carrot in the beginning of the show that we're going to talk about raising capital. I would say 80% of the phone calls that I get from developers who are looking for help with their project is help raising capital. The challenge that I found many developers who are just getting into the business and who may have experience and construction experience with real estate ownership, but maybe even a decent understanding of what the development process is about, they really don't have a lot of understanding of what it takes to raise capital, whether it's additional equity, pref equity, or even getting a loan. The best they know is they could call their local banker or they would call on a broker, and there's plenty of brokers that would help them with debt component of the project. But you've been super successful at it. What advice can you give to a beginner? Where do they start?
Yeah, hopefully it's a beginner in raising capital are not beginner in development, because development is very sophisticated. Development is a lot of moving parts in developing deals, and development is probably the fastest way to go bankrupt in real estate, because you're building something from nothing and a lot of things could go wrong within that journey of times. That's why a lot of banks don't even lend to development deals. They leave that to private lender type of financing institutions. As long as they have some level of track record when it comes to development, and I think that's the basis, that's the minimum needed to have that. But if you have some track record in building a product, you leverage that track record to be able to raise capital for your next deal. It obviously always makes sense to start small, but look at raising capital as a vertical of your company, as another department of your company. So the same way your company has a department in project management, developers always have to be great at project management. And there's a lot of resources that goes into project management. A lot of resources go into acquisitions. Now, in a smaller case, you probably have a couple of realtors that bring you deals, but you still have to analyze those deals, see if it makes sense. That's a department within your company. You know, management is another department, right? So look at raising money as another department that you have to build. So there is a marketing component there. There's an investor relations component there, and investor communications components. You have to build a brand around yourself, around the company, and you have to build the infrastructure internally to be able to not only raise capital, but also stay compliant and continuously raise capital. A lot of great books and a lot of even some great masterminds that help with that. But the basics of it is understanding that just having a deal and taking it to investors is not going to be as simple as that process. Secondly, is who are we going to take it to? Just because you know a few people that might want to invest in deals, or you have some friends and family, that's not going to suffice. So you need to build a database and nurture that database. That's really at the foundation of raising capital, is being able to build a database of potential investors that might invest with you, and then nurturing those leads, nurturing that database until you have a deal that's ready for them to invest. That's essentially how, basics of raising capital. Now, how to go about getting those leads, a lot of different ways. There's different marketing strategies that could be utilized. I mean, the show that we're having tonight could be a way, like somebody could see one of us on this show and reach out and say, hey, I heard you on Eugene's show and I want to learn more about what you're doing there, August. Or they could do the same thing for you, Eugene, if you're doing some development projects. So any way to get the word out to, you know, people know that you're an expert in your field would be the best way. But what happens next? What if somebody does call you and has that conversation with you? Then what? Are you just going to forget about them, or they're probably going to forget about you after you call them when you have a deal in 6 months? No, you need to have the infrastructure. What I mean by infrastructure, you need to have a CRM where that conversation you had, you can go in there, log it in, make sure you log in that investor's name, take detailed notes, put a reminder for yourself to reach out to them, maybe in a couple of months, not when you have a live deal. So you're always on top of their mind. Most CRMs these days also have a functionality to create and draft emails. So you can create and draft a monthly email where you send that email to that database that you've created that say, hey, this is what deals I'm looking at. These deals didn't work out. This deal I'm still looking at. Even if you don't have a live deal, you can still send out emails and give them an update on what you're seeing in the market. So those are great ways through a CRM, through gaining leads to build a database and build somewhat of a following. Now, there is a component of investor relations where you have to also do calls. You have to get on calls with these people. In some cases, leads might come in. You might not know who these people are. And you might say, how is that possible? Well, if you have a website and you have somewhat of a lead magnet on your website, people could click on that lead magnet. They could give you their email and phone number, but that contact is sitting dormant in your database. You need to have an appointment setter who reaches out to them, notifies them, so you're not on these ongoing hour-long calls. After you talk to the guy, he's like, hey, man, I'm in a really bad situation. I'm just trying to get some money to, you know, pay my student loans. You're like, oh, I just spent an hour and a half on this guy who still needs to pay for his student loans. He's not going to have $150,000 to invest in my deal. So an appointment setter does that task for you, gets on a call with the leads that have been created through your marketing efforts, qualifies those leads, and then book someone a call with you so you can be there closing them, or your investor relations team, if you have a closer on the team, they can close them, have them at least making sure that they're ready to invest, making sure they understand your business model, making sure they understand the risk associated with your deal, making sure they understand the structures you use to raise capital, if it's a syndication, limited partnership, general partnership structure, if it's a fund structure, if it's a REIT structure, whatever structure vehicle is that you're using, they understand it. So when you do have a live deal, they can jump on board and invest with you. That's a really quick crash course on idea of raising money, but there's a lot of people out there. There are trillions of dollars sitting in retirement accounts. Americans have, I think Americans have close to $20 trillion sitting in retirement accounts that they can self-direct it into syndicated deals. Syndicated deals are a vehicle that are allowed to be for investors to self-direct. So you have access to those funds as long as that investor knows that you exist. We're in the alternative space. It's a multi-trillion dollar industry. So there's a lot of money out there looking for a home. And people, you know, some people might love development. They're like, hey, I really believe in the idea you have. I really believe in what you're building. I understand this market. This market has huge demand. I want to invest with you, Eugene. Or they might come to August. Hey, August, I love Tampa. You know, my in-laws live in Tampa. I love Tampa. I've been there. They tell me that there's a demand for housing, hard to find a place for apartments, and you guys are buying apartments. I literally love that. And I want to invest with you. You know, here's $100,000. Let's see how you perform. And if you perform well, they're going to reinvest with you, or they're going to tell you about, you know, about you to their friends and family, and you're going to be able to raise more money. So it's a really compounding type of a business, which it compounds over time.
Perfect. So that's an excellent crash course, as you described that. But I think the key to understand for any developer who is trying to build a full-scale business is to recognize that raising capital is a dedicated full-time job that deserves its own vertical in your company. And I talk about it all the time, especially in the last couple of years, that myself included, with 20 years of experience in construction and development, I have been focused so much on the delivery. I knew exactly what needs to be done to get the project designed, to get it permitted, to get it built, we used to have a construction company, so we would trace every subcontractor, we would coordinate all that work. We were super hyper-focused on the delivery, but we would frequently forget that raising capital is a full-time job that requires full-time dedication, as well as, you know, just plain marketing. Capital raise component has its own marketing requirement, but building any business, you know, if you have an apartment building and you need to lease it up, you cannot forget that you need to start marketing that way in advance. You need to warm up that audience, and you have to dedicate resources within the company to do all of that. So thank you very much for that explanation. And I think it's super important for anybody who is contemplating development to understand that it is possible to raise capital directly. You don't need to work necessarily with fund managers or family offices, or find how to get through the door to a private equity fund. There is an entire class of retail investors out there.
Absolutely.
All right. So we talked a little bit about international investing. You mentioned that you started the company in Canada. I recently actually got a couple of phone calls from Canada, and we talked quite extensively about investing cross-border, Canadians investing in American projects, Americans investing in Canadian projects. High level, what can you say about the pros, cons? Is it difficult? Is it fairly easily solvable? What are some of the high-level things that the listeners should keep in mind?
Yeah, I might have some tunnel vision here, but my understanding is there is always flight of capital from Canada to the U.S. Canadians looking to invest in the U.S. And just because of the yields that exist in the U.S., we spoke about rent-to-value ratios, and those rent-to-value ratios are drastically lower in Canada than they're in the U.S. One of the measures that we use in commercial real estate is cap rates. So cap rates are much more compressed when you compare apples to apples properties in Canada and the U.S. Cap rates are much more compressed in Canada. So the yields are just not there. And that's why a lot of Canadian investors come to the U.S. The appreciation is not there. The yield is not there. The population growth is not there. That's been the flow of funds that I've been watching. But yeah, as far as Canadians looking to invest in the U.S. aside from yield, there's tax advantages as well. Obviously, there's depreciation. Now, Canadians can use all the depreciation that exists in the U.S. They're capped at 4% per year, whereas in the U.S., in some cases, you're up to 100% depreciation. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's all about yields. It's all about the business model that might not be available in Canada. Build to rent as a model that doesn't really work in Canada because the yields are just not there. If you build, you build to sell, not build to rent. So yeah, a lot of Canadians coming. Now, there is, when it comes to raising capital, your audience should also know, I'm sure some of them know this already, is that the moment that you go out there and try to raise money, you're overseen by the Securities Commission. In the U.S., you're overseen by the SEC. In Canada, you're overseen by provincial securities commission. So British Columbia has a BC Securities Commission, Alberta has the Alberta Securities Commission, and so on and so forth. So you need to abide by the rules and regulations. So when we structure a deal in the US, we create a US entity. Let's call this our US Master Fund. Even though I call it a fund, this is a project-specific fund. So it's not your classic understanding of a fund where it's a basket of deals and investors have exposure to all the deals within that basket. We're talking about a fund that only has one deal in it. So it's a project-specific fund. So we create our US Master Fund that owns the property. Our US investors invest directly into our US Master Fund. And then at the same time, we create our Canadian feeder fund. So we create a Canadian fund. Canadian investors invest directly into the Canadian fund. The Canadian fund has its own offering documents. It uses a certain exemption to raise capital in Canada. The U.S. fund has its own offering documents. It uses an exemption in the U.S. to adhere to the SEC regulations. And then the Canadian fund invests into the U.S. fund just as another investor alongside the U.S. investors. That's how we're able to give the Canadian investors exposure to U.S. deals and relieve them from double taxation. There's a treaty between Canada and the U.S. that relieves Canadian investors from double taxation as long as the deal is structured correctly. And a good example to use of not structuring a deal correctly is recently, in somewhat recent years, LLCs have become very fashionable. They've become very sexy. A lot of developers, a lot of syndicators use LLCs. But a better entity that is a more tax-efficient entity is a limited partnership. And Blackstone launches a $1 billion or $10 billion fund that they launched somewhat recently, is structured in a limited partnership, not an LLC. A limited partnership are much more versatile. They're a flow-through similar to LLCs, but they allow for international investors to participate without being double taxed, because any type of dividends that goes back to the investor are not seen as dividends. They're not seen as distributions. They're not taxed in the same way. They're a flow-through entity, limited partnerships are, so the investors are not having to be double taxed. Another factor that we've created in our cross-border structure, early on when we launched CPI and we brought on investors, a lot of investors realizing they had to deal with the IRS, that kind of was a hurdle for them to have to overcome. And they're like, hey, I'm already dealing with the CRA, Canadian Revenue Agency. I don't want to have to deal with the IRS as well. And I have to go get an ITIN number. If I'm investing through my corp, I have to get an EIN number. So there was some pushback there. So soon after that, we went to our attorneys and our CPAs and our tax lawyers, and we were able to create a structure where the partnership would file taxes on behalf of the investors. So our Canadian LPs didn't have to deal with the IRS, didn't have to file US taxes. The partnership filed on their behalf, paid the taxes on the US, and then provided them with their K-1. Or the Canadian equivalent, which is a T-5013. They take that to their accountant and say, hey, this is my foreign investment. This is the distributions I've received to date. And please file my taxes. No need to file U.S. taxes. There's a lot to learn on the job as well with us. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to U.S. developers, U.S. investors looking to bring on Canadian investors, the deal should be structured in a limited partnership. But you also have to keep in mind that putting together such a structure and having to be compliant on the Canadian side as well, it doesn't really make sense for one or two investors. If you have, more than that, if you have a strategy to actually target Canadian investors, then it makes sense to get together with a tax lawyer, make your structure compliant, and bring on these Canadian investors, so they don't have to file U.S. taxes. Keep in mind, filing U.S. taxes, even though it's a nominal price, maybe around $500 to $1,000 a year, still over a five-year period, it becomes erosive to their returns, right? If they're continuously paying for that, that reduces some of their returns over the years. That's my brief overview and quick advice I can provide investors looking to bring on international investors.
Makes sense. Yeah. So it sounds like if one does try to specifically target international investors, Canadian in this case, it's better to set up a structure ahead of time to make it easier and simpler for the investors to do that. If it's a one-off, I suppose it could be managed in a case-by-case scenario, but I guess nobody would go into all this trouble for a $100,000 investment. But if you're talking about millions coming in, then it definitely is worthwhile to spend the time to research and set it up correctly in the beginning.
Yeah, the way my experience, what normally happens is the developer the investor on the U.S. side, the sponsor on the U.S. side, putting a deal together, they get a call from some Canadian investor somehow and says, I want to invest in your deal. They call their CPA, who's completely has absolutely is clueless about cross-border. And the CPA says, get the Canadian to create a U.S. corp and invest with that corp or that LLC into your deal. Then you're fully compliant. If they need to be accredited, make sure they show proof to your, send a letter from their lawyer, Bob's your uncle. They don't understand that that investor is not only going to be double taxed, that their U.S. filing and all the costs that they put together on a, at least on a $100,000 investment is going to be so erosive that doesn't it doesn't make the deal financially make sense anymore. So yeah, you could get a few investors early on, but I guarantee that those investors will not reinvest. So yes, if you're looking to bring on international or Canadian investors, get guidance, not from a CPA, but from a tax lawyer who understands how these deals are structured.
Well, and preferably from those professionals who have done that before.
Absolutely. Perfectly said.
So that they're not learning on the job, but on your dime.
Absolutely.
Yeah. August, do you invest in other sponsors' projects or do you mostly do your own?
I mostly do my own. I mean, we've co-founded CPI 5 years ago. We've gone through a whirlwind of events. It's been a very interesting time. It was also this dynamic of Canadian-US investors. We just launched a fund in Canada, which allows us to raise money from Canadian investors who want to use their retirement accounts. And I can get to that in a moment. So my time and resources and brain power has been on CPI this time. It hasn't allowed me to be able to venture out. Now, there's been some small funds that I've put a smaller allocation towards. A fund was launched in Canada that needed to have 150 investors, similar to the fund we launched, to keep the fund compliant. And I was, me and my my partner, one of those investors in which invested there. I invested in a development project here in Southwest Florida, in Naples. It was a spec home built that I invested in as a partner, as an LP partner, a 50% LP partner. And it was a great deal. We made great profits on that. So not really syndications I haven't invested with. I've invested in the debt instrument with a close friend. But yeah, as time goes, I love to diversify, particularly in other asset classes. Like I believe in industrial. Industrial is a great asset class under the commercial real estate umbrella. So I would like to get some exposure because of my scarcity in my time and resources right now. I'm putting a focus on CPI, but we also started our other vertical, which is build to rent. So I'm getting exposure to build to rent on the proxy of just the fact that CPI is investing in build to rent. But yeah, I love real estate. Can't wait to get more diversified and more exposure.
Excellent, excellent. You mentioned, before we wrap up, I just wanted to close the loop. You mentioned the a distinction between syndication and the fund. A lot of times in my vocabulary, I use them interchangeably. I think I understand what the subtle differences are, but maybe they're not that subtle. Do you mind elaborating on that?
Yeah, I mean, the subtle part, to simplify it, is a syndication is project specific, is one deal. It doesn't make sense to go the fund route and create a fund if you're just raising money for one deal. That deal is called a syndication. But now you might ask me, hold on a second. I did one deal and I brought in a couple of investors and they're my partners. One of them helps build. The other one helps to go and get the material. The other one finds the deals. Is that a syndication? That's not a syndication. That's a joint venture. So the most basic part of a partnership where there's more than 1% involved is a joint venture. And most deals are done through this joint venture structure. So it's an LLC, a limited partnership, a corporation, a few partners put together and they do a deal and they bring different type of brain power and resources into the deal. That's a joint venture. That's the basicest way you can put a deal together. As soon as you go to the members of the public and you start raising money and you're being overseen by the regulators, that's a syndication. You're raising money. But syndications limits you to one deal. You're syndicating one deal, right? The moment that you want to now you've done a few syndications, you've done a few deals, you've built a track record, but you're tired of this shotgun approach where you find a deal, put it under contract, then create your legal docs, your offering docs, create your marketing material, take it to your investors, and you hope and pray you can raise the money for your deal before your closing coming up in 45 days. You're like, I'm tired of doing the syndication model. I want to have liquidity. I want to have capital that I can go and have access to go and buy a deal right away. And I'm going to use that as leverage to be able to get accepted at the best and final so they can choose me. And that stage is the stage where you launch a fund. A fund is structured in a limited partnership in most cases. It has its own offering documents. And within those offering documents, it stipulates that says, this fund, this is the fund's mandate. The fund is business plan is to purchase 5 multifamily deals in Texas and Florida. The multifamily deals are going to be value add. It's going to be August and his partners. August and Eugene's are the managers of this fund. They're going to be raising $10 million, or let's say $100 million, and they're going to be going and buying 5 multifamily deals between Florida and Texas. And the plan is to raise money over the first year to 2 years, start buying deals over the next few years, and then execute the business plan in those deals, and then start divesting in the last couple of years. That's a closed-end fund, right? So that fund allows fund managers like myself and yourself to go ahead and start raising money, raise that $100 million that we needed to raise. Now we have money in the bank and we can go out there and buy deals and use it as leverage. That's a closed-end fund. You could also have an open-end fund. Your open-end fund is that you're going to be continuously raising money and continuously buying deals, and investors have liquidity. Investors have redemption rights. Investors can come and go as they please. So that's an open-end fund. So yeah, and then the next evolution after that is a REIT, right? You can be a private REIT or a publicly traded REIT, which gives people serious liquidity. They can go online and press a button and they sell their units or their shares online. Private REITs and funds don't have as robust liquidity rights as the public REITs do, but the yields are also lower in public REITs than funds and syndications. So yeah, that's really the spectrum. You go from joint ventures to syndications, to closed-end funds, to open-end funds, to private REITs, to public REITs. That's really the spectrum of how these deals are structured. But going back to your initial question, yes, there is a specific, and these are just lexicon, multifamily, a real estate lexicon that exists. But yeah, to distinguish between syndications and funds, syndications are for one deal, one project. Funds are multiple deals sitting within this basket of the fund.
Yeah, I would. The only thing I would add to that is that I've encountered many times that people use the term fund to really mean a syndication. So they would really set up one entity, one LLC to invest in one project. It's fully disclosed. They do refer to it, and we've done it ourselves too. They do refer to it as a fund. But if you sort of look under the covers, it really is a syndication.
Yes, no, you're 100% right. A fund is any vehicle that holds money in it. You've heard of a term college fund. You've heard of a sovereign wealth fund, which is a country's fund. So a fund is any vehicle that holds money in it. Yes, a syndication is also a fund. Earlier, if you heard me, I called it a Canadian Feeder U.S. Master Fund, and I said that project-specific funds. But to distinguish for investors who've heard the word syndication and the word fund, when it particularly comes to in real estate and raising money, that's how you make the distinguish. Keep in mind, this whole space, I call it real estate private equity. Anytime you raise money from members of the public to do some kind of a real estate deal, you're under the real estate private equity umbrella, in my opinion.
That's right. That's right. August, are you raising capital for any specific projects right now that you would like to plug?
Yeah, we're not raising any money for any deals at the moment, but our capital raising machine is never turned off. So I invite any investor who hears me on this show or watches me here to book a call with myself personally. I'd love to get to know you, talk to you about deals that we're working on. So yeah, this is my nurture process right now, getting to know investors and bringing them into the funnel. So when we do have a live deal, at least build that relationship with you, so then we have a live deal, we can present it and make our case. I'm very active on LinkedIn, and August Binyaz on LinkedIn. I'm a LinkedIn top voice, so yeah, reach out to me, tell me you see me on the show here with Eugene. I love to dedicate 30 minutes of my time. And even if you're not an investor, if you have just some questions about real estate or some deals, or you want to talk about how to be able to raise more money, book a call with me. I'll allocate 30 minutes of my time for you. Make sure you tell me you've seen me on this show. And check out our website. We have a bunch of useful information on our website, cpicapital.com, www.cpicapital.com. Check us out there. And on social media, you can find me, August Binyaz, or CPI Capital on all social media platforms.
August, this was incredibly amazing. Thank you so much for this wealth of information. I hope this was useful to anybody who stuck around to the very end. Thanks again. Real estate development, land to legacy.